And it's really nice not to see before. It's nice to hear. I love hearing people with Southern accents talking sense, you know, and it comes from you, and it comes from Edward, and it comes from Jim, and it comes from Juanita and other people that call into the show. And it's really important. I mean, the South has given us so much in terms of, you know, food and music and ideas, and it's just, it's a wonderful place, and it's not the kind of thing that we need to just carve off and let sail out to sea like the Southerners wanted to do to Massachusetts, you know.
Right, but I'm really wondering if maybe there's something to be said for that wall, John.
Well, yeah, unfortunately, the people that want to build the wall want to keep the wrong folks out, as far as I can tell. They want to keep the hardworking folks out, right?
Well, exactly. And,
yeah.
But I want to keep the crazies in.
At least you can monitor them that way, I guess. Well, I'm really pleased to hear that you're doing this activism work, because it does benefit everybody, and I know you're going to take a hit, and I would just really encourage everyone, if there's going to be a month this calendar year that they can make an extra sacrifice and kick something towards the horn to keep us going, that would be really wonderful. And it sounds like this would be the month to do it, because you've taken two big hits, and this is really important work. And I would just really encourage folks, if they can, to contribute.
Thank you very, very, very much, John. A quick email just came from our buddy David in South Carolina.
I forgot David. I'm sorry. Yes.
Well, no. And under the subject line, crazy. And David simply says, went to grocery store, forgot I was wearing an Obama T-shirt, had to keep my eyes open. Really?
Wow. Hey, I believe it. Absolutely. No question.
And so, and there are so many joyful things to celebrate, you know, talking about going to the home of the hot slaw. I hope, and I trust he isn't, that my surgeon is not listening. Because if they're open, because they burned down not too long back, but a friend of mine down there tells me they have rebuilt with a vengeance.
Uh-huh.
And I'm going to be like the children of Israel before the Sabbath, gathering extra manna to get them through the next day.
Oh, yeah.
I'm going to load up on barbecue and hot dogs. Because one of the tricks about the hot slaw, John, is that it is absolutely stunning on hot dogs. It's just like one little stripe of ketchup and then a load of that hot slaw, and they press it in some sort of, you know, flat iron. I use two hot iron skillets when I make them here. So the outsides of the buns are crispy and toasty, and they are probably the cheapest weenies known to man.
Yeah.
And they are, and this extends back to the dim and distant days of my childhood, they are exquisite.
Wow.
And so, yeah, I mean, it almost takes on the quality of a pilgrimage.
I love it. I got to try that, and I say take that Chicago and New York. Both great cities. Love the folks there, but love the hot dogs, but my God, that sounds amazing.
Oh, you drop... No. This is paradigm shift stuff. If you were to drop these hot dogs in Chicago and New York,
uh-huh,
it would be revolutionary. The entire hot dog cultures of both cities would change.
Would change overnight. I love everything about my wife, but I got to say, one of the more amazing things is that she introduced me to white sauce.
Yeah, it can't be. And that's amazing. Yeah. Now, see, we got a little clarification to do here, John. Marty just wrote in and said, isn't hot slaw, a.k.a. sauerkraut?
No. Good stuff also, but no, this is different. You better take it from here, Bob.
Well, I will, and here's the trick. Trying to engage in a little cultural exchange and stuff, I left, written in English, I left the recipe for hot slaw in Germany.
Wow.
I mean, this is a nation that went wild over the idea of putting curry-flavored ketchup on bratwurst.
Oh, that's right. Oh, man. This could change everything overnight.
Yeah, I just want to know that it's happened. You know,
yeah.
I don't know, maybe go back in a year's time and suddenly, would you like a verse that's the hot slaw on it?
Yes. An investment hot slaw. Yeah. Well, I've got some friends in Germany, so I'll put out a discreet query and see if they pick up on it.
You know, it's just the Colombian exchange running backwards, John.
Oh yeah, exactly.
You know, we take something as ubiquitous as the kohlrabi, the cabbage, that clearly is European, made its way over here, transformed it into something wonderful and magnificent, and shipped it back.
Yep. And to Europe, you're welcome.
yeah, because things will change. Things will change.
Things will change.
John, have a wonderful weekend, and thank you very kindly for the call.
You too, sir. Have a great trip, and I look forward to hearing about it when you get back.
Thanks. There will be a trip report. And like I said, Facebooking and tweeting along the way.
Excellent. All right. Good night.
Bye now. Dr. John calling from New York. Onward we go. Line's open if you want to jump in. Hey, welcome to the program.
Bob, how you doing?
Pretty good, Bill. How about you?
I can't complain. Nobody listens, you know. Well, yeah, the shrink will listen and the bartender will listen, but they both cost an awful lot, you know. It's one of those things. But seriously speaking, could you run by those dates by me again on the history?
The American History Prism series?
Yeah.
July 2nd and 3rd?
Yep.
5th and 6th?
Okay.
And 9th.
Okay. Yeah, it's nice to get a free education.
And this is that, Bill. It absolutely is.
Those guys know their stuff.
I mean, we'll be starting at 9 o'clock in the morning, and some evenings we may not finish up till 9.
Oof. See, I'm weak in the revolutionary and constitutional period. After that, that Civil War. You start looking at that, and it's like opening up a big river because there's so many other aspects. And learning is funny that way. I got so heavily involved in listening to New Orleans jazz, which you begin to learn a lot of social things from. Like the New Orleans funeral. First of all, a lot of people buried with music in those days. A lot of different groups. And a lot of it in New Orleans came from the fact that getting life insurance was not easy if you were black.
Right.
And you belonged to your lodge, and the part of the lodge insurance was the use of a band. And there's some... I have a great recording by this young Tuxedo Brass Band that Ertegun sent Tommy Dowd to New Orleans in 59. And they recorded these guys, and they're young. Are you kidding me? These guys were pretty darn old then. But, man, and the clarinetist uses an E-flat clarinet because it carries... outside strongly. It's a high, you know, high pitched.
Right.
And you being of Scotch descent, you get this feeling like that reminds me of a bagpipe.
Yeah, true. But, yeah, like the business part of a bagpipe.
Yep. Yeah. The tonality is wailing. This guy was named John Kazmir, who was leading the band at that time and playing the E flat. And what a sound. There's a lot of great bands down there now. Trombone Shorty, and there's a program on college radio here in Cleveland on Monday morning called Fat Monday, P-H-A-T. And they, when I wake up listening to the guys I have on record that have been dead since 65, and you never thought you'd hear them on a radio channel. You know, I have a good collection of that stuff. I should sell it. But you're going to be gone a long time. I'll miss the hell out of you, Bob. But,
there will be reruns, Bill.
Yeah.
But
it has to be done, man. Bless you, because you hit it right on the head. And I had some interesting encounters with young men from West Virginia in the 1950s, mid-50s. Some of them weren't real friendly. But, hey... none of them ever resorted to guns and clubs either. You know, it was that typical, let's play football in the middle of the game, somebody will throw a punch at somebody, you know, that kid stuff. Typical.
Well, but again, you know, this kind of goes, it goes back to, I mention him a lot because I miss him horribly, Joe Bajant. You know, you can go to joebajant.com and just spend days there. But that one brilliant essay that he wrote called Eat, Pray, Fight.
Yeah.
is an exploration of what it is to be Southern and Scots-Irish.
Yeah.
And to try to understand why it is that we'll throw, many of us will throw a punch as quick as look.
Well, Senator Webb, you know.
Yeah, said much the same thing.
Yeah,
But if you want writing style, there's no beating Joe.
Oh, no, absolutely. And the people he hung with out there in Colorado, and was it Denver? He was out there with some of the old Beat Generation people who were out there.
Oh, yeah. New Timothy Leary, new Dr. Thompson. Right.
Yeah, that was a great place to go. He wasn't a writer when he went out there, was he, really?
No, he was, he had a hint that he wanted to, but it wasn't the origin. He was just kind of being a young guy at loose ends and trying to figure out what he wanted to do with his life after getting out of the Navy. I think that's how it went. Couldn't hardly bear to go back and go up Shanghai Road and live there.
Yeah.
And carved out a niche for himself and did so brilliantly. Like I said, there is, if you just start with one and start following the links.
Yeah. I heard some of the interviews he did. I got those off the net.
Well, somewhere back there, and I searched when we heard that he had passed away. I searched my emails. I asked other people to search their emails. Joe Bagent remains to this day the only individual in the history of the Horn to whom I have ever given the entire body of a show. And there is somewhere in the archives, if anybody wants to go searching. There is a 3-hour conversation with Joe Bagent I was rapt.
Well, you're strong on the mark yourself in the recent filibusters. You've been really, what's the song, Preach and Teach, buddy?
Yes, and you know, somebody, the choir needs preaching too sometimes.
Well, we all have to have it reinforced, because sometimes I'm getting sort of to the point of depression with this whole society that I start thinking, well, what do I do? Just go out and pick some guy out I don't like, smack him and get it over with? Because it's just getting tough to listen to these people.
Yeah, but see, that's the thing, Bill. You're not a psychopath, so even though you might think about it, you will, because you have a well-functioning brain, talk yourself out of it.
Yeah. Well, you know, I carry...
Under most circumstances.
I carried for quite a few years, depending where I was living in the city, in certain neighborhoods that were, I came home from doing a job one night, and I'm getting out of my vehicle, and I'm getting some dog and cat food out of the side of my van. I was driving a van in those days, and I turn a world around, and there's four guys, construction crew. They had hammers. Big monkey wrenches. Of course, it was 3:30 in the morning. And the guy says, well, we're righteous. I said, well, you want to stay that way too, don't you? Because I was pointing at him. Who the hell are you? 3:30 in the morning in the inner city of Cleveland. And these guys were all Caucasian, by the way, in case anybody's wondering. So, you know, it's got nothing to do. Ethnicity has got nothing to do with this kind of stuff.
No.
Idiots come and desperate people come in all shapes, sizes, and one of these days I'll meet one from Mars if I keep listening to that Nori at night, you know. You never know. Well, my mother had some books in the early 50s by some guy who lived on the slopes of Mount Palomar. I can't think of his name. Flying saucers have landed inside the spaceships. And they were quite interesting when I was like 13 or so, because some of these people that he was bumping into were really very, very nice creatures. They had an ethic to them that, you know, the same one that Palestinian day laborer had.
Right. Stop hating on each other. Stop killing each other.
Yeah.
Right. Right.
Yeah, that kind of stuff. And I have a real hard time. I got a kick out of Jim. He's a show music listener and classical music. My sister was the complete opposite of me. Classically trained mezzo, who listened to the opera every Saturday, and so did I, because it was loud. And, and the show music. I used to sit when I was messing with clarinet and play Get Me to the Church on Time and some of these other show tunes just for something to dabble with. One of my proudest jobs was in 75. We did two shows on a Sunday afternoon. You know, one where they clear the house between sets?
Yeah.
Shows with Bonnie Raitt.
Oh, wow.
Oh, she was something else.
Yeah.
She grabbed my guitar player at that point in time, was trying to get him back to come back to the hotel with her. And this was a great guy. He said, no, I got to take care of all this equipment. I thought to myself, you moron, you. But that's another story. I think she was still wanting to, she was going to try to talk him into down the road and playing for her.
Gigging.
Yeah, because he was that damn. That kid was, he was 17 when we opened for Cream at Grandy Ballroom in Detroit, and he was using a Sears 610 Dan Electro amp. Dan Electro was the guy who built it, marketed under the Sears name. They were great amps. They were really strong.
Oh, yeah. I'm well familiar with the brand.
Yeah. You know, it was just a strange time, and I look back at it now and said, you know, I sometimes said, man, if you had been born into a middle-class household, you would have had a history degree and, you know, hopefully taught at some small college or high school or something, and retirement would be a lot easier than, you know, because, man, I miss playing like crazy. But a lot of blues up here now, but a lot of these guys never, ever listened to anybody, you know, except late model stuff.
Yeah. No, you got to go back to the roots, don't you?
That's where the guys like me who started in the mid-60s professionally and even earlier amateurishly, so to speak, we had one hand deep in that market, deep in those in Muddy and Chess, and it was, the blues was all over the country. The stylistic differences are fantastically. The Texas guys ended up in Oklahoma, guys immigrating out to Oakland. And then meeting another Caucasian wild man, in this case Johnny Otis. Just it was you know, this guy Louisiana Red. Did you ever hear him?
I don't think so.
He did an LP in the early 60s, and it was real folkish from the effect that one of his songs was Red's Ride, and it was a chronicle of the Reverse Freedom Ride that he was offered. You know, Citizens Committee giving away the fare. If you don't like the South boy, go on away from here.
Yeah.
Somebody got to Little Rock. Bought something to eat, but when I got my sandwich, I had to eat it on the street. You know, there was a story there.
You know, that reminds me, you having the, I didn't realize this was coming out, but you having the literary and musical bent that you do, this might mean something to you, Bill. And I know your vision is compromised, but still. I've wondered for a long time when this would actually be done, and apparently it has been. Not a lot of reviews out there yet, but here, I think, in a few weeks, lo and behold, On the Road, Kerouac,
yeah,
is going to be released as a film, a major feature motion picture.
Oh, man, great. It's about time.
Well, it is. The question being, did they do the book justice? Did they do the era justice? And is it more than, you know, looking at faded photographs, if you know what I mean?
Yeah. I had that weird birthday of the mid-war, and I was a radio kid growing, you know, the first 5 or 6 years before we even had a television. And, you know, these kids that I was hanging with calling themselves hippies, and they said, oh, you old beat, you. You know, they used to give me a hard time about being a little older than them, you know. But, yeah, he said so much, and he caught... Of course, he ended up pretty conservative in his old age, didn't he?
Well, he didn't have an old age.
Yeah, he was like 47, I think.
But he turned into this hard right-wing, Vietnam-supporting drunk.
Yeah.
And wound up dying of some sort of massive hemorrhage after eating living with his mother in Florida, and died of a massive hemorrhage after eating a 1-pound can of tuna or something.
Jeez. Of course, with the stuff that might be in that, you know, I'm getting to a point, Bob, everything I've gone back to using a bread machine, baking my own bread again. My grandmother baked it, but she did it the old-fashioned way, you know.
Oh, I understand. This is not some sort of elitism, but after my little jaunt across the pond, I can't find a loaf of bread anywhere that even begins to compare. I mean, I've joked about the beer and everything, and it is amazing. But really, the lasting impression is the bread.
Yeah.
I mean, it really is the staff of life. And if you sit down with two or three slices of that out of a toaster and a little butter and maybe some cheese or meat, yeah, or just jam and butter.
Yeah.
One, the jam is not going to be made with high fructose corn syrup. The butter is not going to be made with bovine recombinant growth hormone milk. And the bread is not going to be made with GMO grains. And that bread is, by God, Bill, bread. I mean, it's dense, and it's rich, and it's flavorful, and it's not this gluey, cellulose-laden stuff that comes in a bag called marked Wonder, because it's a wonder the human system can digest it.
Yeah, why is that? We have the same sense of humor. My line was, you wonder if it's bread or not.
Yeah, it's a wonder anybody can eat it.
Yeah, exactly. We're a couple of sick humorists, I'll tell you.
But no, I mean, I had that for breakfast every morning over there.
Oh, yes.
And you know, I'm somebody who likes to get up and, by God, have breakfast. And guess what? I felt like I had. By the way, you got some email in from Isaac. Isaac is a friend of George Clinton's.
Oh, my God.
And he said, Bill mentioned Trombone Shorty.
Yeah.
Bill has great taste. His real name is Troy Andrews, and he has done some shows with George.
Huh?
Great talent. In fact, it took me a minute to recognize the name, but you might remember some time back I was going down and doing broadcasts at West Virginia State University for our friends at Seneca 2. Well, at one point in time, they had either just gotten done or were about to host Trombone Shorty in a show there at West Virginia State. And it took me a minute for that light to go on, but yeah.
It's good to see these younger... You know, the Marsalis brothers, their dad, Ellis, was a piano teacher in New Orleans, and he jammed it down these guys' throats as to where they came from and the tradition of that city. And those guys can actually play older-style jazz convincingly when you consider how much education they've had, you know, musical education. That's one of the differences.
Oh, like, yeah, the real old-school stuff, the Big Spider Vic.
The guy I liked was this clarinetist named George Lewis. And when they rediscovered this trumpet player, Bunk Johnson, they put him with George's band. And Hal George was in Europe quite a bit. There was an YouTube of him and Acker Bilk doing Carina, the two clarinets just winding, because Bilk was the guy who tried to steal George's style, you know, Stranger on the Shore. The big vibrato in there, that's New Orleans clarinetist. The French clarinet teacher could be pulling their hair out because it's so contrary to what classical players were taught.
Oh, without a doubt.
Although New Orleans, before Plessy and Ferguson took good hold, there was a Creole of color philharmonic or symphonic orchestra in New Orleans also. And people were, you know, it's a whole different society that, you know, I had trouble as a kid because I was living in an integrated neighborhood, and I helped make it that way. And, you get on we were on trackless trolleys in those days, and you get on, and you sat next to anybody. And when all this stuff hit the fan, you know, with this integration, I just couldn't understand what the problem was. No problem for me, you know. I went and sat and talked, and whoever the person was, you know, Jesus. Because it's a shame, because I have a problem, Bob, sometimes with people with a Southern accent, and I don't like to, because, you know, it's not that way with everybody.
No, but when you hear so much ignorance being pronounced with it, it's hard not to associate one with the other.
Yeah, and it's a shame, because it shouldn't... I often ask myself how the Southern working class man could go out and charge cannon and mass musketry so that some rich guy could have a better shot, you know?
Right.
And that's a crime, because these were some of the bravest. Who did the movie Gettysburg based on Killer Angels?
Was it Shiraz's book?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah,
I know Ted Turner had a hand in the production of it.
That was the guy, yeah. And, man, did that open my eyes to what I had been only able to visualize a lot in my mind as to what these guys did. How they did it, I'll never know. Well, of course, then again, I just lost my father-in-law, my second wife's father. He was on Saipan and Tinian and Iwo. And he broke his sons a few years ago into some of the things that he saw and didn't like done by American Marines. And then he said the kids told me it was real tough for him to talk about things that he saw that were done to wounded people and prisoners and such that were not, you know, not what we're taught, you know.
Right.
Because that situation, anything's liable to happen.
And sure, and nobody, and in the midst of war, no one has a lock on, on morality.
You spent some time in Cleveland with your dad at the clinic, didn't you?
I did.
Well, I heard you speak of this. I've been in there. They've done a little work on me.
No, they saved my... There's no getting around. They bought my father another 10 years.
They know what they're doing. I don't... They've had some problems, believe it or not, with some staph infections and such, which makes you wonder about certain aspects. And I can tell you a good story, but I won't tonight, but... a friend of mine who was an electrician there, that I heard from him that hit the papers.
Well, my father was there, Bill, at a time when some sheikh or emir or sharif or whatever had an entire floor, and this was a nice thing for me. The whole hospital smelled of roasted lamb and various, you know, the various other Middle Eastern delicacies. And it was delightful.
Well, if you came out of the clinic walking onto Euclid Avenue and made a right turn and walked three-quarters of a mile in the late 50s, early 60s, you would have been in the middle of the our version of Storyville up here.
Really?
Well, that's where I was hanging out when I was 17. Great organ trios. And, you know, and if you mind your own business... and didn't bother anybody, nobody messed with you. That was a different situation. I don't know what's happened in our society now that we reach a point in so many areas of life where desperate people do desperately stupid things.
Well, I think there's that, but to a certain extent, in unofficial ways, there's a lot to point to the idea that this country is rapidly resegregating itself.
Yeah.
When officially as well, when you've got Southern senators of the United States saying, my state don't need to be regulated by the Voting Rights Act, we ain't lynched nobody in forever.
And you and I know that the things that Dr. King fought for in the 64 Civil Rights Bill had been in the Constitution since the post-Civil War era.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
They were nothing new. They were things that... it was supposed to be a part of everybody in this society. that area was a great one, and we also have a big market house up here which is celebrating 100th anniversary. City built it, and when they first laid it out, they were going to put in baths and washrooms because of it was opened 100 years ago this year, and that's how primitive it was in a big city. There was still a bathhouse on the route I took to my eighth grade school. Because at one point in my life, I was using the recreation center. Because the place I was living, my landlord, who was a friend of mine, he never bothered to do any plumbing work. And I wasn't about to do it for him. It's his house, you know. I did enough on my own when I owned him. Yeah, it was, so they're loaded with, they did a special on PBS up here, and the bakery should talk about this. One German place, I buy some of their rye bread, is just out of this world. And there's a woman who makes sourdough rye, which is...
Yeah.
I was thinking of Tracy the other week. I was coming back in a cab, and I had a... There's a young woman I have for an health aid who's as old as my daughter, and she's amazed by me. She says, you know, I work with people, with older folks, and I haven't met one like you yet. I said, get ready. You're going to see a whole lot of them. When the boomers start to come into retirement, you know.
Right.
Because that whole 60s era was a different world, man. But anyway, I said something to my health aide about the one percenters. And this young woman, well, I don't know, young, she was in her 50s, cab driver, just left to the defense of the Republican Party. I said, boy, keep talking. Your tip's getting smaller by the minute here. it's hard for me to deal with. And one of my best friends who grew up with...
But you know what? I don't necessarily think that's a bad thing, Bill, because the fact of the matter is, it's a tactic they use. I got a right-wing blast email from Donald Wildman of the American Family Association of Tupelo, Mississippistan, just yesterday, I think, saying, here is coffee you can drink without running the risk of supporting any liberals.
No. Yeah, I know Schultz has a big coffee sponsor. And a lot of people don't like Ed, but from the standpoint of the unions, he does that part of his work well. That's all he can do, fine. Stay with it.
Yeah.
Everybody needs the kind of... I mean, your stuff, I wish to... I hate to talk about this guy that I don't think exists, but hope to somebody that people could hear more of your work. Although I love the conversation style. That's, you know, I get on with some of these folks, you got to cram everything in real quick to get something across.
Yeah, you wind up feeling like an auctioneer.
Yeah, exactly. I was with some woman on the West Coast last week. They were talking about voting rights, and about 30 years ago, I knew a bunch of people who were still talking about, in their mind, only landowners should vote. Now, if I'm not mistaken, that was a constitutional issue.
Yeah, it most assuredly was, and that was the way the Constitution was originally constituted.
Who fought to get that changed?
Well, there was that dust up in 1860.
Oh.
But no, I mean there was the one that the teabaggers and the right wingers really love to harp on now is that they want to go back to when folks didn't get to vote for no senators, when the Senate was properly appointed by the state government the way the framers and founders and Jesus intended them to be.
Yeah. Leave Jesus out of it. He wasn't of the convention, was he?
He was there in every spirit and every soul, Bill.
Okay. I know if he came through the airport today, he'd get arrested.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, yeah. You mentioned tips running downhill in a hurry.
Yeah.
Well, you know, turnabout is fair play. And you know who this Russell Pierce character was? He was the lawmaker who was bosom buddies with that Kobach creep from Kansas. And was instrumental in ramming through SB 1070 in Arizona.
Which is?
The papers please law.
Oh, that one, yeah.
Yeah. Well, he got booted out of the Senate. He was recalled.
Yeah, okay, now I know you.
I mean, this guy is a fellow traveler with various and sundry skinheads, knuckleheads, right wingers, Nazis, you know, real Nazis. That not used as a generically critical term. Real, you know, goose stepping. Right.
Yeah, there's a lot of people like that. You remember George Lincoln Rockwell?
Oh, sure, sure. Well, here's a little case of turnabout is fair play. And if you can imagine the gall of doing this, for starters, he wants to get back into the Senate, and so he's got him an election campaign going to get reelected to the Senate. Russell Pierce does.
Yeah.
And part of me goes, I'm ashamed. Part of me thinks I'm ashamed of being happy about this, but the other part of me says, you know what? Revenge is a dish that is best served cold.
Yeah.
And so he was trying to find somewhere to have himself a little campaign fundraiser event. You know where this pasty-faced, doughy moron went, Bill?
Hmm.
Mexican restaurants.
Oh, Jesus Christ. Good place to eat.
Now, what else did he assault while in office? Public schools. So he also went to a public school library, trying to find somewhere, on the cheap, of course, to have himself a campaign fundraiser. And the two Mexican restaurants and the one school library said, you know what? You might want to be going and campaigning somewhere else.
Good. Good. About time that somebody once in a while tells these people the same crap they hand to everybody else.
Well, that was my thought.
Well, you know, and I won't keep it but another minute, but you know what the school thing is about. It's not just about wages. It's about sneaking Jesus in the back door.
Well, and well, beyond that, it's also about the general desire of a whole lot of white people in this country to eliminate any sort of social safety net, public commons things, if they have the least suspicion that those public commons might be accessed by people not quite as white as they.
They are, yeah.
And so, and you know, there was an overt attempt to destroy public school systems in the immediate aftermath of Brown versus Board of Education.
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah,
with the white flight and the creation of all those Southern academies.
Yep. Yeah, I remember that too. And as I say, it's a shame because it's, you know, like there are certain country musicians that they just hit me hard. Marty Robbins did a thing called Don't Worry About Me back about 1960 with a fuzz tone in it. And that was the first time I'd ever heard that thing being done, you know. And he could sing. That man could sing. Well, you worked for Phillips, and he had a slew of white guys that could sing.
Oh,
and, before
a few of them.
You know. Yeah, before that, he was recording blues. A lot of it. And I won't keep you, but it's just, you know, do your damnedest out there, because this situation, that Maria Gonneau, that situation was enough to... There's a hole in my wall about the size of my head, I think. After I heard that story, I said, Jesus God, what is with these people?
Yeah, and so far there has been utterly no remorse manifested by Representative Lamborn or any of the other godless, soulless, motherless Republicans who pulled that filthy stunt.
Yeah. Well, someday we'll have to sit and talk. I met Dennis when he was about 19, Dennis Kay, and what a guy he was. I mean, he knew the city, and he admired a guy named Tom Johnson, who was mayor here in the early 1900s, who was a millionaire, but didn't act like one. And Dennis really respected this guy's work, and what they tried to do to him to get him recalled was he wouldn't give up our municipal light plant to let the private plant dominate the whole place totally.
Well, remember when he refused to sell off the muni, not only that, but the mob put out a hit on him.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah, that's another side of my life, that my dad's brother worked for the fellas. I remember going to his house in about 49 and 50. I'm a little kid, and there's six slot machines there. My uncle made my dad put money in them before he let me play them. Nice family, you know. I laughed so hard at those two guys. They were good friends.
Yeah, I guess you saw where Henry Hill passed away, right?
Oh, yeah. Somebody was just talking about that. And the story that we were discussing, it was that the guy Hill worked for was not that big a man. Was not that big in the group.
Yeah, it was the Lucchese family, wasn't it?
Yeah. And what was his name? Paulie. He had a good-sized crew and such, but he was not, you know.
That far up the food chain?
Yeah. And I remember that thing that happened in Appalachia. Yeah. Well, what they call up in New York State, when those guys were having a meeting at...
Oh, yeah, it was was it Appalachia, Pennsylvania, or Appalachia, New York?
New York.
Yeah.
And some guy cruising past all these Lincolns and Cadillacs with all these young guys standing out there laughing and joking. And there was a scene where some of these guys were trying to run through the woods. It would have been hilarious watching guys with expensive suits and, you know, Stetson shoes running through muddy woods. Would have been hilarious in itself, you know. But anyway, you go ahead, because I'm sure I hope there's a bunch of people. And thanks for those dates, because, man, that's one thing I ain't gonna miss that. I mean, anytime I had some friends that went to Case and I used to go down, and Bill Randall used to teach communications, and I'd go down there and check him out because of his, he was somebody I listened to in 55 a lot. He brought Elvis to Cleveland in 55 to a high school. And he came to hear me one time, and that was a thrill, believe me, when you see a guy that had as much knowledge of music as he had, and to see him sitting in an audience in a bar that you, some of these bars I played in, you look around and you say, man, I wouldn't come in here for a drink. This place looks too rough for me. I'm out of here. Anyway, have the best trip possible.
Well, thank you, Bill. I appreciate it. You have a wonderful weekend, and we'll talk when we get back.
Take care, sir.
All right, and bye now. Bill, Mr. Stress, calling from Cleveland. If you're from around Cleveland, you know the name, Mr. Stress, a bluesman of extraordinary talent. It is about 16 minutes before the hour. No, it isn't. It's about 26 minutes before the hour. Going to have to find the reset button on that clock once that I don't want to end this 10 minutes early. But I want to do something real quick, a couple of things, because when Bill mentions music as being good music, and Isaac says he's got good taste and sends along a clip, I figure you might very well want to hear that. So this is Trombone Shorty. The track is Due to Me.
I know you came here to move. Showed up tonight, so to show and prove. I know you feel so good when you're feeling the groove. And I can show you how it's done. But hold on, not so fast. You got to feel it, make the fire last. You wanna feel it from me, I wanna feel it from you. I tell you what you gonna do, what you gonna do to me. What I'm gonna do to you, I bet you like it. What you gonna do to me. What I'm gonna do to you, I bet you like it. The lights down low, safe and sound, about to pay them go. I bet you still want more, I bet you still want more. And then you shake it like a thing that's for crazy, and be holding out, waiting till no one's around. There's no better place than here. There's no better time than now. What I'm gonna do to you, I bet you like it. You like it.
want you to know we're still in the Gulf.
There's fishing in Mississippi.
There's shrimp in Louisiana. You know what sucks about shrimp? Eyes.
Ooh,
eyes. I don't want anything looking at me when I'm eating it.
Now the Gulf features eyeless shrimp.
With 100% less eyes.
Since BP poured oil and dispersant into the water, things just got awesomer.
Ooh, sounds exotic.
Best of all, scientists say it's
probably
completely healthy
and probably
fine to eat. Come to the Gulf and see what BP's been up to.
We're spending big money on ads to remind you.
BP never left.
Now we'd like a f***ing cookie or something.
BP, we're still slathered all over the Gulf, and now we'd like a f***ing cookie or something.
We'll be right back.
Couldn't resist the little interlude there. We had Trombone Shorty as recommended, as mentioned by Bill and recommended by Isaac, and due to me. Wow, that was hot. And then by request, a little something for Jim. Soul Food to Go by the Manhattan Transfer. And between it, a brilliant, utterly brilliant piece of satire by a group calling themselves the Partisans, about the fact that when one orders shrimp, Gulf shrimp, you remember the passage from the sadly named ruination of the wonderful book Forrest Gump, in which Bubba says, we got boiled shrimp, fried shrimp, shrimp etouffee, shrimp burgers, shrimp gumbo. Yeah, that one. Yeah. Well, now all of that comes to you without eyes. Thanks to BP. And I love that line. We're BP. We want a cookie or something. You can, if you want to view the clip, because the video with it is equally good, it's over at Raw Story. Satirist thanks BP for creating eyeless shrimp. Everything's okay. They didn't need it. You know, they crawl around on the bottom of the ocean. So what do you need with eyes? Right? Yeah. Let's, well, not much left of conversation radio for, yeah, a little over a week or so. Let's go to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome, Jim. It's a wonderful song.
I think it is, too. As a matter of fact, on the same CD is a Nightingale playing in Barclay Square.
Oh, that disc has a lot of classics on it.
Sure does.
Tuxedo Junction, which might be appropriate to my coming journey, is also on that, the very best of the Manhattan Transfer.
Tuxedo Junction, where are you going?
I'm headed to Alabama. A little bit nervously. But you know the lyric to Tuxedo Junction begins, there's a place down in Birmingham.
Birmingham, yes, sure do. Sure do. I've heard that many times.
Yeah.
God, Lord, have that former generation certainly had some wonderful songs.
Oh, yes, they did.
Today. And I appreciate you playing that. And hope you have a good trip down to Alabama, Stan, or wherever you want to call it.
Well, I wish they wouldn't do things that gave me the inclination to call it that.
Well, unfortunately, that's...
I've never been even the slightest bit nervous about returning to that state. Now I am. I'm wondering if I should take my passport.
Well, we don't have internal passport systems yet, so you have to worry about that. That's for sure.
Yeah, but not gonna. I think I've largely lost my Alabama accent. It's mostly a hillbilly accent now. It might be taken for foreign.
I don't think you have a hillbilly accent, Bob. You know it, and I know it. Any more than I do. But anyway, you know, there's one place in Alabama that I remember where it wasn't so bad. That was Huntsville because of the federal presence there.
Right, and the massive NASA and Redstone Arsenal presence.
Yeah, you got it. Absolutely.
In fact, not turning everything on my recent travels, but my first experience with so-called German food came in Huntsville, because of course when the Second World War ended, we promptly rescued Ferner von Braun and all of his buddies at Peenemünde.
Oh.
And hide them hence.
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, it was either that or Stalin would get them. So there it is. And they fathered our modern-day space program.
Yeah.
I mean, von Braun was a rocket enthusiast from his earlier days, but then he got hooked up with... the Nazis, and I think he was even put in jail once. He was jailed because the SS had taken over the rocket program, and, you know, while Von Braun was talking about going to the moon, the current people in charge wanted to develop the bus bomb and the V-2. And he was locked up for that.
I remember, I forget if it was Firesign Theater or whom, but they had a little rhyme one time, and it was quite, well, at the time, quite humorous. The rocket goes up, who cares where it comes down? It's not my concern, says Von F. M. Braun.
Well, that's the way those things were. I mean, they basically pointed them in the right direction toward London, and that was it.
Oddly enough, it did not accomplish its stated goals, however, because the British did not become terrorized and simply knuckle under and sue for peace.
No, they did not. But the terror was there. I know a British lady. She's passed away, but she remembers those buzz bombs coming into London where she lived, and she remembers taking her son, who was a friend of mine, and all she could do was hide under the stairs. And you know, and I don't know how many thousands of people those rockets killed, but nonetheless, those sites were sort of put out of commission once we got ashore in France and began to knock them out. But they still began to fire them, and they would, you know, they developed the first mobile launching system and all that kind of stuff.
Oh yeah,
right. You know,
and consequently, the folks of Huntsville, Alabama, were introduced to such magnificent Bavarian delicacies as Rouladen and Sauerbraten and Spätzle. And nothing has been the same. When I was a little boy, we would stop there. Huntsville was 72 miles to the east, as I noted earlier. And it was a bigger town, considerably. It's freaking huge now.
Oh yeah.
It's just an exercise in sprawl. It has the worst driving in the state of Alabama, I believe. We would go over there for shopping because they had a mall, Jim. Maybe the first mall in Alabama.
Mm-hmm.
And in that mall was a little place called the Old Heidelberg Cafe.
Mm-hmm.
And my father would sit down in there, being quite responsible, and drink a cold German beer. The only place he could get it, because it was legal. It was legal to drink. It was legal to both have and drink beer in Huntsville, Alabama, because they never would have gotten the Germans to stay had it not been.
Well, I guess not. I mean, that's a good example.
We'll take Stalin. He'll give us beer.
Right.
So, but I grew up in a dry county, and you know what those are. And so my father would sit and drink a cold German beer, and little bitty Bob would get bowls of warm sauerkraut and warm sweet and sour red cabbage, and little plates of spätzle. And it began a love affair that has yet to end.
Well, I can understand that. I still enjoy that affection. You know, there's another place in Wisconsin near Vogt Field, and I cannot remember the restaurant for save my life, but it was an incredibly good German restaurant because I had to go to Wisconsin because Fort McCoy was there.
Was that the expedition during which you spotted the painted cows?
On Route 5, this farmer had actually painted COWS on his cows, and I stopped, and I just asked him.
Why?
I said, how you doing? He said, where are you from? I said, D.C. And I said, why do you have COWS on your cows? I mean, I was thinking of Rose Nyland and St. Olaf. I said, what's going on? And he said, these crazy idiots come up from Chicago, and I have several shot. I said, you mean to tell me they don't know the difference between a cow and other types of
ungulates?
Of playing game? And he said, no. No. He said, I'm totally serious. I was driving.
Well, and you know, from the cow's perspective, it beats the hell out of having cow branded on them now, doesn't it?
Well, I guess it does. Certainly, it certainly does. And from whatever happens to them, God knows, I know.
Well, yeah, I've got friends in southern West Virginia who have periodically referred to cattle, people who grew up hard, mind you, refer to cattle as slow elk.
Oh, my Lord.
You know.
Slow elk.
Ain't had no meat in a while. We're going to go out and take a slow elk.
Well, I'll tell you, I had some good times in Wisconsin, and, you know, Fort McCoy was a good place to be. I mean, it was just strange, interesting for me when I first went there because the winters were so terribly bad. But I did have the opportunity on the weekend to go down Route 5 to La Crosse, which is a really neat town. And at the airport at La Crosse, there's all this Amelia Earhart.
Oh, wow.
Amelia. Yeah. And I'm not sure, and I never could quite make the connection because when I went to the airport, there was always some blue bus or some car waiting on me, so I never could really ask anybody. But there were all these pictures of her and things like that at the La Crosse airport. Just a little.
I'll be darned. We'll have to investigate that. And by the way, thanks for pointing out that this is Magna Carta Day.
It is. I mean, that was the first step toward relinquishing absolute power.
And, you know, after Richard the First and after Richard the after John the First, I'm sorry, you know, because it was King John who was such a miserable screw-up that the barons rebelled against him. You realize the English have never had another King John to this day.
I've noticed that. And, you know, it's like I say, it's a landmark in history, and it's a tribute to the heritage of many of us. And I just thought of it a few minutes ago about June 15th, 1512, or whenever it was, or 1215.
On the field at Runnymede.
You got it, absolutely. Absolutely.
And I always wondered about that because as an amateur brewer at one point in time, I became quite adept, Jim, at making mead. Because I always wanted to know what it tasted like, because in ninth grade, you know, they made us read Beowulf.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, everything centers around the mead hall at Heorot, not a beer hall, not a wine hall, it's a mead hall. And I wanted to know what it was that could give you enough courage to go and rip the arm off a monster.
Well, you take some honey and mix it with whatever they do, and I'll guarantee you one thing.
It gets righteous.
Yes, sir.
And then in learning my world history and the history of what did Winston call it? Winston Churchill call it the history of the Anglo-Saxon speaking peoples. Runny mead, because once I knew what mead was, you know, it pours out. You can either make it sparkling or you can make it still. But I couldn't imagine what runny is. That mead that you've made too thick? Or is that mead where something has gone terribly, terribly wrong?
I don't know whether it's made too thick or made too wrong. If you have enough of that, I'll guarantee you it'll put you in a land where men are men and sheep are nervous.
Yes, indeed, and monsters have one arm.
There you go. Well, listen, have a good trip to Alabamistan.
Yeah, D.C. first, then Alabamistan.
Well, good luck with D.C. I know that's very dear to your heart, and it's dear to the hearts of a lot of people. I hope that something will be done. I hope they'll listen. But anyway, listen,
thank you very kindly, Jim.
You take care. Have a good trip, and thanks again for Manhattan Transfer. But like I say, for those other people who would like them, they ought to get the CD and hear a Nightingale sing in Barclay Square. That's a beautiful song.
It is. It is. Originally, Vera Lynn, was it?
Vera Lynn, yeah, your father used to listen to her.
Yes, he did.
Told me that, my father too. And she's just incredible.
Well, take care, Jim. Have a good weekend, and we'll talk soon, I hope.
Okay, take care. God bless.
Bye now. And thus we come to the end of Friday on the Front Porch, what seems entirely too soon. This has been a fun one. It's been a great couple of weeks. I'm sorry to be away. And I'm not trying to inflate my own sense of worth, but this is and has been very special to me and very important to me. And I hate being away, but this is, to my mind, utterly, absolutely, unconditionally necessary. So we will talk soon. And you can always friend up on Facebook or follow me on Twitter. And I'll be tweeting along the way, and I hope you'll join in on that. Thanks for your kind contributions, four of them this evening. got us $260 toward the $300 we needed to raise this evening, and I think that is pretty amazing, and I thank you very, very kindly. Thanks to our all-volunteer staff, and thanks most of all to the hardest-working, bravest people I know, the folks at Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net, and stoptheache.org. Go there and learn how you can help end Appalachia's agony. And always, 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 Gina, Judy.
Here we go. Head on with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation cussing and discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head on with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Pycod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Looky here, it's Monday, the 11th of June, 2012. A new week beginning. I'm Bob Kincaid. This is The Horn, the Head On Radio Network, America's liberal voice. We call what we do here conversation radio. It's a little different from regular talk radio because here, you are the experts. And consequently, there's a little more time goes into conversation here than goes into it in other programs. It takes a little longer for experts to make their cases and make things plain and clear. We are listener-supported radio. It is your contributions via the PayPal button at headonradionetwork.com. Or by snail mail, the address for which is also at headonradionetwork.com. It's your contributions that keep this program and this network up and running. We seek to raise something on the order of $2,500 a month to keep the bills paid, the wolf away from the door, and the packets passing and the streams streaming. We seek to raise, winds up being about $100 a night. And we are badly behind in June because we spent the first days of June catching up with what we didn't make up in May. Bills do still need paying, and your contributions are what makes that possible. So any help you can give is much appreciated. Here we are at the beginning of the week, as I noted. The beginning of our week, generally because of what we see happen over the weekend, the beginning of our week is often fraught with the actions of folks who are, shall we say, atne ute aitbre, if you one what I ime. That is why the first day of the broadcast week is dedicated to the Morans. Get a brain, Morans! That's right, it's Moran Monday on the Horn. Step right up. Hurry, hurry, hurry. Get your programs here. Get your programs for the very small, small change price of less than 5 cents per hour of broadcast time. You can tell the Morans. You just can't tell them much. This is the program that does it. Right here, behind this thin, cybernetic veil of canvas, you will find all manner of morons. Right-wing morons, each and every one of them. Republican morons, teabagging morons, 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 morons. Women are advised to keep close hand upon their clutches, their purses, their bags, as morons have been known to pilfer. Small children are not advised to look directly at the morons, as the retina can be burned. No one will be admitted after the first 5 minutes of Moran Monday, so step right up, hurry in, head for the hills, or you'll be up to your armpits in morons. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. It is. It's Moran Monday on the horn, and we have a fine crop. Yeah, you remember when we were talking last week about... Well, let me back up just 1 second. Before we jump too far into Moran Monday, I want to make a reminder, a recommendation. Toward the very end of Friday's show, Mark called in from Florida, and this is not moronic. This was brilliant. This was a moment. This was one of those little magic horn moments that are neither scripted nor looked for, but just happened because of the brilliance of the people who shared their time in this program. Mark called in toward the end of Friday night's program, and he gave a brief but oh-so-telling description of what life would be like in Romney's America. It was amazing, and I received a number of comments mentioning it. And at some point, I need to sit down and pull together the audio for it and get it out there for you somewhere, because it deserves to go far and wide. It was brilliant. So if you want to, it is within the last 10 minutes of Friday's show. You'll find it there. I had talked with Preston. We closed out our conversation, and then Mark was the final caller of the evening. Okay, check that out. Romney's corporate America, because the question, and this does go to Moran Monday, the question of what does Mitt Romney's America look like, you know, in light of his statement that he doesn't want any more firemen and doesn't want any more teachers or police officers. What does he want? What are we all supposed to be? You know, I had a conversation with Boss Man Wayne over the weekend, and I said, you know, does he want us all to be ditch diggers? No. Maybe he wants us all to be Walmart workers, but if we're all Walmart workers, we can't afford all the crap that Walmart sells. And that was Boss Man Wayne's observation, so it just continues to spiral down the toilet. Is that what Willard Romney wants? Does Willard Romney just want Somalia? Does Willard Romney just want to be Haiti? Poor, poor Haiti. I read somewhere in the past week, the past few days, of there having been gold discovered in Haiti, and I thought, dear God, please not that. Poor Haiti does not deserve that. You know, you can say the same thing of Haiti that I believe it was Porfirio Diaz said of Mexico. Poor Haiti, so far from God, so near to the United States. But what does he want? Well, he's a moron, so he probably wants something pretty damn stupid. I mean, here we go. For instance, the right wing is doubling down on his no more teachers, no more cops, no more firefighters language. And this has a couple of different levels of moronity to it. Over on the Mouse Channel, ABC, this week with George Snuffleupagus, his guest on Sunday included Fox News host, the Reverend former Governor Mike Huckabee. And this is the first part of the Moran inquiry. What the p- is Mike Huckstervey doing as an, some sort of expert panel guest on This Week with George Snuffleupagus? He was brought on, apparently, to stand as some sort of surrogate for Willard Romney. The question... Hold on one second. This coming from George Snuffleupagus. Hold on one second. I'll ask the governor about this. How about the ex-governor, former governor, the not governor anymore? I'll ask the governor about this. What is wrong with jobs for teachers, firemen, and police officers? Well, let's let this just happen in the flesh. Let's go to the audio, because it also includes Van Jones. And it's worth listening to.
Hold on one second. I'll ask the governor about this. What is wrong with the jobs of teachers, firemen, and police?
Exactly.
If you look at,
I can tell you, there's nothing wrong with it. My dad was a fireman. I love fireman jobs. But here's what you need. You need enough firemen to put out the fires. You don't arbitrarily go hire firemen, policemen, or teachers unless you have more kids in school. And what we need to be talking about is not hiring more teachers, but hiring better teachers.
All right. Moran moment right off the bat. First of all, the panelist also includes Anthrax Coulter. She's made it to the big time. She's on the respectable Sunday Talking Head program with George Snuffleupagus. She was probably going to suggest that she was trying to wedge her opinion in. You heard the babble at the very beginning. I'll tell you, she said. They're all communists. That's probably what she was going to say, because, you know, Anthrax is kind of predictable. But the Reverend former Governor Mike Huckstervey gets his lick in instead. And he starts right off the bat with a premise that I think, well, you just heard it there, that I think we need to analyze. He says, we need enough firemen to put out the fires. Obvious, one might think. But to assume the obvious with the likes of Reverend former Governor Mike Huckstervey is to tread on shifting sand at best. You need enough firemen to put out the fires. You don't arbitrarily go hire fire policemen or teachers unless you have more kids in. Okay, we're going to see what I mean? Well, we obviously don't have enough firemen to put out the fires. I hate to keep stirring through the ashes of a world turned upside down, but that did kind of get proven, didn't it, in Tennessee, when a fire department stood by and watched a man's house burn down because he had not paid the fire subscription fee? If we still have fire subscription fees in this country, as Robert, our buddy Phase 5 from the chat room, pointed out, then that means we're not getting the job done. It was Robert who sent the email who said, well, you know, the fire in Australia, you call up, you say, my house is on fire, the fire brigade shows up and puts out the fire, no questions asked. That does not necessarily happen here. Sometimes they show up and sit there on their trucks and scratch themselves and watch while your house burns down, because you didn't pay the fire subscription fee. If we are going to run around prattling things like, this here America is the greatest, richest country in the world, then by God, we'd better have some of the things that makes countries great, like enough infrastructure to keep from having to sit by and have the firefighters watch the house burn down. So there goes the Reverend former Governor Mike Huckabee. Not exactly what you'd call double plus good right off the bat, but let's give him a fair hearing, for God's sakes.
Teachers and getting rid of the ones that don't teach. When 50% of the kids in Chicago, where Obama's campaign headquarters is located, aren't even graduating, we need to be talking about improving education, not just increasing the number of public employees who in Chicago get $100,000 a year in salary and benefits.
I see. It's Chicago's fault. Are you listening, Chicago? Aren't you ashamed of yourselves? It's all your fault. That we cannot answer that question that George W. Bush so elegantly put some years back. The question is our children learning? It's your fault, Chicago, because you're paying your teachers too much. I personally think $100,000 a year is probably what a teacher deserves. I would far rather see teachers make NBA money than NBA players, or NFL players, or Major League Baseball players. But that's not how it works in an upside-down country. You know, the rude pundit, whose columns are quite often, almost always, salted with some delightfully coarse language, had a column not too far in the distant past, or not too far distant in the past, that had not, I think, and it may have been a record, it had not one dirty word in it. And it was about teaching. I think, I can't remember which one of you sent that along. But he talked about teachers in Denmark versus teachers here. I thought so much of it that I sent it along to Dr. Bill. And if you want to go and find the Rude Pundit and find the column, it's worth the read. And it talks about the real education failures in this country. But this is how the right wing operates. Well, we got teachers that are making $100,000 a year. Well, shit fire. We got hedge fund managers making tens of millions of dollars a year, and I know they're not worth that. They're just shuffling stock certificates around. They're not teaching your kid to read. They're not making the quadratic equation accessible to a 13-year-old. But the Reverend Governor Mike Huckabee doesn't like for teachers to make $100,000 a year because, you know, them teachers is liberals. And then let me put it another way. If you don't want more teachers, it probably means you desperately need more teachers. Do you see my point? If you don't want more teachers, it probably means that you lack the essential education to recognize the depth of your own ignorance. Well, I'm getting along just fine without no teacher. I quit school. I was 16-year-old, and I went to work on mountaintop removal site, and I drive D9 Caterpillar, and I does just fine. Thank you very much. Last year, I bought the old lady a brand new tanning bed, and I got me a new four-wheeler, and life is good, and I don't need none of that education. if you think you don't need teachers, it's a pretty much sure enough, no kidding, sign that you need them worse than you even think, or than anyone knows. But here, let's let the Reverend former Governor Mike Huckabee continue.
Look, first of all, you know...
Wait a minute. This is going to be fun.
Employees who in Chicago get $100,000 a year in salary and benefits.
Okay, so here comes the smackdown. Sit back and enjoy. Get the popcorn out. This is Van Jones.
Look, first of all, you know, maybe I was raised wrong. I never heard of this threat to America called public employees. In my neighborhood, we called them teachers. We called them firefighters. We called them cops. We called them nurses. And we were taught to look up to them and to respect them. And to have for it to now be a punching bag to people like my father and my mother, who were public school teachers, who did not make $100,000 a year, whatever you just said, and nothing near it. For them to become a punching bag is wrong. Furthermore, I think we need to take a big step back here. When you have the amount of pain that's happening in the country, the Republican Party has not only been missing in action, they won't pass their own bills to help Americans right now. They won't pass their own ideas to help small businesses right now. Why? Because their gains will come when America has more pain. It's like having a lifeguard trying to help.
You saying they're rooting for failure?
I say they're rooting for failure. It's like having a lifeguard. Obama's a lifeguard trying to help people drown. These guys are sitting back on the rock hoping more people drown.
And
that's wrong.
And it's the truth. You might also remember from Friday's show that I pointed out that one excerpt that our chat room moderator Lottie had sent along. The one that gave a list of Republicans who attended a meeting in early 2009 to discuss what they needed to do to attack, to destroy the American economy so as to make the presidential administration of Barack Hussein Obama appear to be a failure. Okay, yeah, thanks, Marty. If you want to go find it, it's the Rude Pundit piece from 31 May 2012. So... yeah, they are. They're not just, with all due respect to Van Jones, they're not just rooting for America to fail. They are working to make America fail. And that in itself is, come on, anti-American. It's okay to say it. Republicans are anti-American. Because if you oppose the Constitution, and showing up with your little tri-cornered hat and your stupid little Gadsden flag and your flintlock rifle is as some sort of costume party cover-up is not supporting and defending the Constitution of the United States. If the people that you directly support are hell-bent on its destruction. You see? This is the reality. They weren't just rooting for failure. They weren't just sitting on the side of the pool watching, hoping more people drowned. They were throwing anchors at them. Hey, kid, catch this. Oh, another one gone. Blame that one on that anti-colonial Kenyan Muslim in the White House with a deep-seated hatred of white people. See how it works? Sure. Marty noting, maybe Willard wants us to become Colombia. You know, Colombia during the Bush years. Pick a Bush, either Bush. Maybe. Maybe indeed. But no, we've got more ends o' plenty. You remember the story last week from North Carolina about how North Carolina's Republican legislature was going to make sure didn't nobody consider none of that damn science in considering whether or not people are going to be walking through seawater up to their necks in what, Kitty Hawk? The Outer Banks? Inner Banks? In 50 or 100 years' time? I ain't going to have no science. Well, apparently, that kind of morality is catching. Because North Carolina sneezed and Virginia got the sniffles. that phlegm can spray away, I guess. This is the story of Virginia House of Delegates member Christopher Stolle. Stolle. That would be appropriate for a Republican. S-T-O-L-L-E. Christopher Stolle has declared earlier in the year that climate change and sea level rise, can't you just hear how freighted those phrases are? Well, that's because, according to this right-winger, those are liberal code words. And consequently, climate change and sea level rise, those phrases would have to be excised from any language about studying the future of old coastal Virginia if anybody wanted them, anybody wanted those bills to pass. And the vote, there was a vote on the bill, and the vote was passed by the Republican legislature of Virginia to the $138,000 study. But they had to take out the word sea level, phrase sea level rise, and change it to recurrent flooding. Flooding isn't flooding when an abnormal amount of water rises above some channel or banks or overflows periodically as a result of some intermittent event. Isn't that what flooding is? And when it's recurrent, doesn't that mean it happens again and again and again? Isn't sea level rise, on the other hand, when it comes up in and it stays there? Of course, the Old Dominion has a right-wing governor who I believe went to either Pat Robertson or Jerry Falwell University. And they don't believe in that liberal climate change. Human beings can't affect the climate. It's the world. How could human beings affect the climate? We're just people. All right? So now, after all of that happened, there is a persistent campaign to make the Virginia Department of Environmental Quality stop using either the term climate change or the term sea level rise. Instead, those phrases have to be replaced with Mr. Orwell, have to be replaced with coastal resilience. Coastal resilience. Because, see, that ain't no liberal code word, that coastal resilience. The stupid. It hurts. It really really hurts. But of course there's also mean stupid. And mean stupid is probably best exemplified, at least over the weekend, by Karl Rove's icky little group, who tried to, the super PAC, run by Karl Rove, it's called American Crossroads, tried to jump out there and get out front of what they thought was sure to be one of them political scandals. The U.S. Secretary of Commerce, John Bryson, was cited over the weekend for felony hit and run in Los Angeles. He had a car wreck. He drove away. He had another car wreck. He drove away. He had another car wreck. Three separate collisions in the space of a very few minutes. American Crossroads immediately took to the Twitter and posted the following. How does @CommerceSec have three car crashes in 5 minutes and alcohol not be involved? #skills. All those American Crossroads, they're just a bunch of goofy clowns. They're a laugh a minute, aren't they? Yeah, not so much. It is possible to have three car wrecks in the space of a few minutes and not be loaded, which it turns out this was a case of, he said, hanging a preposition out to dry at the end. Secretary Bryson had a seizure behind the wheel. And it caused him to wreck his car three times. No indication of alcohol being involved. No indication of any improper conduct. The man had a seizure. Shh! Don't tell the American Crossroads geniuses, but that could happen to them too. After the events of Saturday, he was given seizure medication. And I'll at least credit American Crossroads, the thugs over there, because their spokescreep is Jonathan Collegio. Their spokescreep, Jonathan, at least had the common decency to tender an apology. The tenor of the apology was this. Quote, the hashtag about his driving skills attempted levity, but it communicated poorly. We took it down. I regret the tweet. Yeah, because now here's a car, three car wrecks in the space of a very few minutes. Naturally, that's just hilarious. At least in the Republican mind. It is just funny as hell when people wreck their cars and maybe harm themselves or possibly harm others. That is a real knee slapper. I mean, it's a laugh riot, laugh a minute, ha-ha fest, right? But only if you're a Republican who finds human suffering awfully damned funny. Yeah, did you hear about him? He done had three car wrecks in the space of a few minutes. I ain't heard nothing so funny since that balcony collapsed with all them people on it who got killed. I ain't heard nothing funnier since that man had to stand there at that deadbeat what wouldn't pay his fire subscription fee. He had to stand there and watch his house burn down and watch the fireman watch his house burn down. I tell you what, I laughed for days about that one. It was an attempt at levity. Yeah, don't quit your day job, Jonathan. Or maybe do. Wander off into the desert and try to find your soul or something. Yeah. Morons. The morons you have always with you. Here's another one, not surprisingly. Tony Norman Perkins of the Family Research Council, a sure enough bona fide no kidding hate group. Noting that June is Gay Pride Month. Well, I don't even like to say this kind of crap. Let's let Tony do it himself. Don't trust me. Listen to the man's own words. By the way, as you listen, remember, this man is a Christian. He's a follower of the Prince of Peace. All-knowing, all-seeing, all-forgiving, all-loving. Yeah.
The month of June is Gay Pride Month. Now, I've not yet seen where they have declared Adultery Pride Month. I've not seen where they have declared the Drunkenness Pride Month. Here's the issue. JR, it's not a matter of whether or not someone, you know, can do what they want to do with their lives. God gave Adam and Eve a choice. But that's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about redefining the rest of culture and making others both embrace, celebrate, and subsidize. You know, we're talking about changing the laws that will influence what our children are taught in schools. It's already happening in those states that have legalized same-sex marriage or had it forced upon them by the courts. We're talking about religious organizations losing their religious freedom. That's already happened. Church facilities in New Jersey have lost their tax exemption because they refused to allow their facilities to be used for same-sex commitment ceremonies. We're seeing issues of public accommodations where because of the passage of these laws, people can, depending on what sexual orientation they may have at a given time, can use whatever facility, public facility they want. These are issues. It's being pushed. We never asked for this debate. I entered into public office working on marriage policies to promote marriage. But it was the homosexual community that wanted to have this discussion about redefining marriage. So it's not that these other issues are being ignored or that they're not important. You're absolutely right, JR. Whether it's adultery, whether it's any type of sexual immorality, it's a problem. But we're not celebrating those other forms as a society. We're not promoting it and teaching it as normal in our schools. And where they do bring it up, yes, we do address them. This is where the battle lies right now for the future of our country.
Now, wait a minute. Okay, so that was Tony Perkins. Now, listen to his... This is not just an exercise in hearing how hate-filled the right wing and especially the religion of peace, right-wing Christian religion industry are. This is not all only about that. This is also a little exercise in how right-wing talk radio works. So, Tony has blathered on, and now it's time for the caller to talk.
Most of the problem that Christians have is that, you know, you don't see people that are drunken or adulterers trying to force their beliefs on others. You don't mm-hmm. See them trying to instill their ideals on others.
In fact, we have law when it comes to drunkenness. We have laws to try to protect the rest of society.
That's right. You gay folks, you're just like drunks behind the wheel. Society needs to be protected from you. Because society might actually catch the gay. I mean, look what happened to poor Senator Larry Craig. Upstanding, fine Christian man that he was, walked into a Minneapolis, Minnesota airport restroom, and the next thing you know, he was trying to have gay sex. I mean, you don't even necessarily know when you're being exposed. One minute you're sitting there, and the next minute you're tapping your toe with your wide stance, and somebody's putting it through that where it's terrible how it happens. You know, and Tony mentions it. These places, these states that have had gay marriage forced upon them by the court. Forced! Let it cram down their throats. That's what they usually say. Cram down their throats. Like some sort of matrimonial goose being turned into foie gras. Church facilities in New Jersey have lost their tax exemption because they refuse to allow their facilities to be used for same-sex commitment ceremonies. I guarantee you that's a damn lie. If the church lost its tax-exempt status, it wasn't over the fact that they wouldn't let a couple of guys have a wedding reception there. How can I guarantee you that's a damn lie? Because it came out of the mouth of a member of the religion of love and peace. You know, the right-wing religion industry. But that little exchange there, I mean, you heard how much of it was Tony Perkins, you heard how much of it was the caller. That is how right-wing radio poisons this country. Cletus, or whatever his name was, J.R. J.R. was probably all excited and about half breathless and nervous because he's going to talk to a great man like Tony Perkins. But he didn't have a thing to worry about because Tony was going to do just about all of the talking. But isn't that just sad and sick? Comparing two people who love each other enough to want to commit their lives to each other and their mutual betterment and perhaps even raise a child, a probably decent, good child. Comparing in the name of Christ Jesus those two people to habitual drunks. Jim noting via email, hell, Bob, every month is drunkenness and adultery month in America. Ain't that the truth? Ron in Raleigh. Hey, Bob. Senator Craig was, in fact, practicing his tap dance routine for the Senate talent show. Tapping sounds better on tile floors. True. And you'll notice that Tony Norman Bates Perkins said that he used the word subsidized. We're talking about redefining the rest of culture and making others both embrace, celebrate, and subsidize. Tim noting via email, subsidized? And the Christian church isn't subsidized? What are tax breaks? And churches losing their 501c3 for not allowing LGBTQs for not using their facilities? Churches aren't required to open their facade to anyone other than Christians. But if they start politicking from the pulpit, then yes, Tony, you will lose your goddamn 501c3. Tim says, typical Christians, lying. That's what they do. They're told not to in their little book. But they pay no more attention to that than the proscription on eating shellfish or the prescription on wearing the two different clothing made of two different fibers woven together. And polycotton blends, especially the short sleeve shirts, are real big in the religion industry. Yeah, it's all just stuff to ignore. But the problem is they don't want to let us ignore them. See, this is the ultimate. This is where it all falls apart. This is where the center will not hold. I absolutely support the right of anyone in this country to believe anything that they want to believe. And I think they should be left alone about it. I do not, however, support their right to try to compel me to believe it. Especially when I have enough knowledge to realize that most of it is made up horseshit. Mostly having to do with the fear of death. People spend so much time fearing death that they wind up not living their lives. By the way, other morons. I had a conversation with Matt Osborne last night. Osborne, Inc. You can see his posts over at the Horns Facebook page quite often. And Matt wanted me to know, since today is Moran Monday, Matt wanted me to know, and wanted you to know thereby, that he had done found himself a moron. Only this wasn't your everyday, ordinary moron. This was a real pencil neck. And you will find his story over at Osborne, Inc. And it's called The Randy Taylor Hahn Burn Notice. You know, we have frequently had conversations on this program about the way that right-wingers will sort of try to inveigle their way into progressive discussions, progressive organizations, solely to poison the well. And Matt appears to have found one of those. If you follow the Twitter, you know that there's a hashtag out there called StopRush. And it got a lot of traction, and a lot of people poured a lot of energy into it. Because, you know, Rush is a turd. And along comes this guy called Randy Taylor Hahn. Who said that he was a wealthy Texan. You know, all Texans are wealthy, right? He was a wealthy Texan, formerly a close personal friend of the late prophetess Molly Ivins. And he wanted to hire him some people to run Stop Rush Texas. A number of people were interested. There are a lot of people out there of very good will who would like to see that jiggling gas bag Dominican all boys weekend illicit Viagra taking OxyContin munching for the refreshing burst of flavor freak go away. But it turns out that all these people who at least had conversations with this individual were basically sucked into a con. This guy, he tweets at far left of right. and has, as Matt notes, been adding thousands of followers every day of late. Matt knows a lot more about the tweets than I do. He has sock puppet accounts. His blog posts are one and all plagiarized from other places. The Google is an amazing tool. Matt notes his latest post on the death penalty is a copy and paste from New York Times. His previous post about the presidential election was cribbed from Reuters and The Week. Then there was a post about Walmart, and he took that from Business Insider. Part of his post on gun control came from the Christian Science Monitor, another part from the Associated Press, and he tweets a lot about his post on Molly Ivins that was patched together from an indie blog post at IndieWeek. It would appear that the only person he hasn't plagiarized is me. And that's only because this is all audio and so seldom goes into print. But this is, you know, this is how that other side operates. He claimed partial ownership of a building in Houston. And he is, as Matt notes, either a pathological liar or he is part of a right-wing effort to infiltrate an effective little operation, Stop Rush. There is some conjecture that he is a black bag op, as Matt puts it, for a Texas-based association of Breitbart zombies. Frustrating, isn't it? You work in an effort of goodwill to do the best you can in the best way you know how. And the other side, rather than putting forward their own ideas competing in the marketplace thereof, because they have no ideas, because they throw rocks to drowning swimmers, as Van Jones alluded, instead they simply try to take down your efforts because their politics are the politics of hate and fear. Just sad. But the upshot is, if you are following far left of right, you might consider unfollowing, because the odds are you are participating unwittingly in a scam. And thanks to Matt for doing the work necessary to bring that out. Jim just noted Tony Perkins. I hate the fact this ass bears the same name of one of my favorite actors. I used to see Anthony Perkins in New York City at the International Grocery. Yeah, it is frustrating. Anthony Perkins is a wonderful actor. This Anthony Perkins is a beastly vomitorium of hate. Kevin writing in, and he says, you might tell the Horn family to go to signon.org to sign the petition to the federal government to end this one church's tax-exempt status. They apparently hung the president, hung, in effigy on church property. Well, that's just our free speech because he's supporting them homos and, well, it's the soul of America, the fight for the struggle. Jesus, I read about that. It was sickening. Done, of course, in the name of the Prince of Peace. And, of course, it would not be Moran Monday, and I kind of saved this as the cherry on the sundae, as it were. It would not be Moran Monday if we didn't follow up on the exploits of that servant of the Almighty Dollar. Creflo Dollar. Isaac and Sandra and I have been following this all weekend. The police report came out. This is a beautiful thing. He not only grabbed his daughter by the neck, this man of God, he also is alleged to have punched and choked her and hit her with a shoe. No kidding. Now, the hustle that Creflo Dollar runs is called the World Changers Church International. It is in College Park in Atlanta, down near the airport. He took to the pulpit on Sunday in his 30,000-member megachurch and said it was all made up. And his parishioners, his flock, his congregation, oh, they just clapped and they stuck their little hands in the air and, oh, praise Jesus. I will say this emphatically, he said, I should have never been arrested. I want you all to personally hear from me that all is well in the Dollar household. He was charged with misdemeanor counts of simple battery and cruelty to children. You know, suffer the children. He's just, yeah. His 15-year-old daughter wanted to go to a party, and they argued. She says her father charged at her, put his hands around her throat, began to punch her, and started hitting her with his shoe. With his shoe. The Dollar's 19-year-old daughter also said that he grabbed her sister's shoulders and slapped her in the face and choked her for about 5 seconds. In the name of Jesus! She said her sister didn't fight back. Then he threw the 15-year-old on the floor. Dollar's wife, whose name is Taffy, told the deputy she didn't see anything. Explaining it to the congregation, he said, "The truth is that a family conversation with our youngest daughter got emotional. And emotions got involved, and things escalated from there." This is where the miracles come in. He said those were not fingerprints on his daughter's neck, but that's eczema, and she's had it for about 10 years. She was not choked. She was not punched. There were not any scratches on her neck. But the only thing on her neck was a prior skin abrasion from eczema. Anything else is exaggeration and sensationalism. I will never put any fault on my children, as Jesus would never put any fault on me. And the people in the congregation hollered, "We love you!" Nobody threw panties, but, you know, "We got your back!" He explained to them the difficulty of trying to raise teenage daughters in a culture of disrespect. Jesus God. Dr. John writing in, he says, self-delusion. Where would Christianity be without it? Reminds me of that line from The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance. When the legend becomes fact, print the legend. Embrace the myth, right? Right, Dr. John. Marty, further proof there's no God. He wasn't struck by lightning. Yeah, it's the absence of those lightning bolts. Maybe we're expecting more from Yahweh than Zeus was capable of. But, you know, Zeus left the party too. Clayton, the militant sociologist, noting, he just wanted to make sure she suffered. You know, suffer the children. Right. And this end, by the way, also from Dr. John, with regard to Tony Perkins. Tony's projecting again. He projects so much you'd think his name was Bellen Howell. Tony's projecting again. Society needs to be protected from the right wing, not people who love each other. See how easy that is? I have yet to hear of a divorce being caused by gay marriage, but, you know, there it was in Tony Perkins. We're talking about changing the laws that will influence what our children are taught in schools. It's already happening in those states that have legalized same-sex marriage or had it forced upon them by courts. Of course, we haven't legalized marriage equality here in West Virginia. And the proof of that lies in the fact of, well, I played the audio for you last week. Little Caden Cowger, 14 years old and just a bubbling over with hatred for the homos. Caden got a little bit of the real world comeuppance this week, however. His platform through which he spewed his filth and his hate, this 14-year-old moron, his show was pulled down, and all of his archives were pulled down too, as a violation of the host's terms of service. Naturally, in further proof of what we started talking about at the beginning of the program, as to how if you think you don't need teachers, it's probably proof that you need them worse than you know. The right wingers took to the blogs to complain that. Little Caden's First Amendment rights were being violated. And I don't think anything makes me whomp my head off the table more than that argument. His First Amendment rights, see, he's speaking the truth of Christ Jesus, and his First Amendment rights has been violated. His rights of free speech. Right? Right. Wrong! Young Caden Cowger did not have a First Amendment right to have a private for-profit company help him spew his hate. Now, he can scream in his basement all he wants. He can walk outside into the backyard and spew his religion of peace-born hatred. But he can't. but he does not have a constitutional right because the First Amendment speaks to the government suppressing one's freedom of expression. All Caden did was run headlong into that there free market of which he professes so much fondness. But there were the ignorant right-wingers.
He's violating his freedom of speech.
No, no, no. Just no. So that brings us pretty much to the close of this Moran Monday, Moran Monday filibuster. I am not going to go 3 hours this week. I am not going to do that to you. One of those in 8 years is enough. I do, however, want to note to you that I received an email from our good friend Darlene. She said, I'd like to make a challenge this evening. I'll match contributions up to $100 for tonight's program. That means if you guys all or one or several of you pull together and contribute $100 to help keep the horn afloat, Darlene will match that $100. So that we will actually begin catching up. So that's out there, and thank you very much, Darlene. It is much appreciated. That's ten at $10, or $2.50s, or $2.40s and a 20, or you can make change anyhow you want to. But Darlene will match up to $100, and it is greatly appreciated. Thank you very kindly. And there we are. We are on our way. We are now only $70 away from meeting Darlene's challenge. Thank you. Thank you very kindly. Ron and Raleigh asking, hey, Bob, you think we'll see this headline anytime soon? Creflo Dollar found dead of multiple gunshot wounds, daughter charged. It's a possibility. Our pop culture correspondent David says this is the ultimate song for during the break. This is for you, Creflo Dollar. And this is the horn. I'm Bob Kincaid.
How to love and live your life. But about it twice. The push or push, the fix or fix. The judge or quit, the judge can lose his mind. For the dollar bill.
For the dollar bill. Learned much too late. He was a never home. He worked two jobs and quit at home. He had to call.
Thinking ahead means preparing for the future. The future of our children, our grandchildren, and our wild, wonderful West Virginia. Developing our renewable energy resources is the best way to ensure a clean, sustainable way of life and safe, good-paying jobs for generations to come. Here in the Mountain State, our most abundant energy resource is the wind. Our ridges and majestic mountain peaks shape and direct the wind like stones in a mountain stream. Coal River Mountain is the ideal place for developing wind power. The Coal River Mountain Wind Farm will provide us with a source of clean energy and good jobs forever. We have the power to make our future happen now. Be a part of the clean energy solution for West Virginia by visiting coalriverwind.org or call 304-854-2182. That's coalriverwind.org, 854-2182.
It's your second hour in the Liberal Sandbox, and you're head-on with Bob Kincaid.
The inimitable announced talents of the legendary B-Rez. Thanks, B. We need to bring B in. We need to maybe cut some new imaging or something. Although that has put us in good stead for low these many, many years. It's about 12 minutes past the hour. A little note being passed on for our buddy Michael. Good day from the chat room when he pops in. A tweet or Facebook. Facebook or tweet? A comment from one of our favorite musicians, Jason Isbell. If the Bible were written today, I bet it would have chapters like Jonathan Franzen's email to people from North Carolina. I did miss it, Michael. I'm glad you sent it along. That's brilliant. Yea, verily, I say unto thee, science is real. And no matter how you don't like to talk about it or use it, well, there's an old story about Noah where God says, how long can you tread water? And the same question applies. So let's go forthwith with Darlene's challenge on the table and us $70 from meeting it. Let's go to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
I'm on.
You are.
This is Edward in Dallas.
Well, hey, Edward, how are you?
I'm fine. Thank you very much for telling us about that scam about Rush Limbaugh. And Molly Ivins is turning over in her grave.
Well, indeed, indeed.
Yes, I'm very fond of Molly Ivins. I can't say I knew her. I met her and we talked, but I didn't really know her. But she's a fine lady.
Well, see, Edward, that's the difference between you and this other guy. He probably never met her either, but he goes ahead and just makes stuff up.
Yeah, he did. And I couldn't wait to get the Progressive every month so I could read her article. And now Jim Hightower has taken over.
Well, she is much missed. God broke the mold.
You're telling me. Well, I called some friends in North Carolina last night. We, believe it or not, were both of us. He and his wife were in undergraduate school together back in the dark ages. And so I called Dan and Evelyn, and I said, what in the hell is going on in North Carolina? They said, we've got a complete Republican legislature. I said, say no more. And this thing about the oceans rising and all that stuff, good grief. I grew up on the coast of North Carolina, and we used to sit out on the front porch and get the sea breeze that came in early evening, and we could hear the surf roaring. My granddaddy's house was only 6 feet above sea level.
Right, and yet it boggles my mind, Edward. It does. I can't fathom it. Who knew? Who knew that climate change and sea level rise were liberal code?
I
mean, if it's code, what does it mean? Is it are those scientific code, liberal scientific code words for gay marriage or something? I can't.
I have no idea. I know the fishermen and down there have a little clue about such things. Why don't they go ask them?
Yeah, no kidding.
As they used to say down in Beaufort, that we used to speak a rather unusual lingo down there, and we were told when we went to college that it was Old English, and the fisherman would say, toy, toy.
Toy,
toy. No fishing today.
Toy, toy, no fishing today.
No, toy, toy.
Oh. Oh, toy, toy. I'm sorry. Yeah, toy, toy.
Toy, toy. We had a rather unusual accent. There weren't any bridges in those days. You had to get everywhere by boat.
Oh, but of course, it's been vastly overdeveloped now, but...
Oh, please. The last time I was down there, my cousin and I went down to Moorhead City to the Sanitary Fish Market, which is a marvelous restaurant, and looked out across Boak Sound, and there were all these condos, and we both agreed... There's no way we would live out there.
it is so beautiful that the 1% decided that they all wanted to live there.
That's right. You got it right there.
And I saw the same thing happening when I took that trip to the to coastal Georgia,
mm-hmm.
The last autumn. And lo and behold, you know, there are these islands that were settled by freed slaves. And the 1% have moved in on them and set up tax schemes to make it impossible for them to be able to pay their taxes, so they run them off the land, and the 1% then buys that.
Well, see, you used to be able to go down to the Sound. That's the body of water between the mainland and the Outer Bank.
Right.
And you could just in a few minutes, you could dig a bushel of clams, and there were scallops, and there were oysters, and conchs, and...
I'm getting hungry.
All that stuff, you can't get it now because it's all polluted.
It's all gone.
Yeah. Bye-bye.
And for what? And for what?
Yeah.
Well, Edward, I thank you very much for your call, and I appreciate you you catching that that's, you know, I don't like any that plagiarism, really. I mean, it's Twitter.
Well, I tell you...
It's 140 characters. What do you need plagiarism for?
I'm going to warn my friends about that if they hear about it, because nobody I know likes Largemouth Limbaugh.
Yeah, no kidding. You know, the Stop Rush effort is valid and good, but this guy trying to inveigle his way into it, not so much.
Not so much.
Yeah, and the Twitter handle is far left of right.
Well, thank you, and take care, and keep us informed.
All right. Thanks a bunch, Edward. You have a good evening.
You do, too.
All right. Bye now.
Bye.
Calling from Texas, that's our buddy Edward. Onward we go. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob. It's John in upstate New York.
Hey, John. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing great. Let me just say I just really best wishes and much love for Edward. You know, I came up in Texas, and it does me good to hear someone from Texas talking a lot of sense.
Isn't it refreshing? Isn't it just refreshing?
It is. Well, I'll tell you, I'm sitting out on my porch in my Save the Endangered Hillbilly T-shirt.
Awesome.
And, and it's just about sweated through from all this global warming that ain't happening.
Right.
But really, the reason I called tonight is there were two stories. Maybe we'll just talk about one that came up when you were gone, and I just really think that they need to be addressed.
Okay.
And the one I wanted to start with was, and maybe finish with, is the situation at the newspapers in New Orleans and Birmingham and Huntsville. And people, if they missed this, those three newspapers are later on this year going to be going down to printing 3 days a week. And that's going to make New Orleans the largest American city without a daily newspaper. I think it had been
New Orleans
before.
The Times-Picayune?
Well, the Times-Picayune, which published every day during Katrina, won a Pulitzer Prize, and their office was underwater. And they are no longer going to be printing every day for the people in New Orleans. And this is, I know from what I speak here, and I've been in that industry for a long time, trying like hell to get out of it for various reasons. But I know all the talk about mainstream media, and I know all the talk about, you know, overpaid talking heads who shill for the right wing, and I'm with you, and I understand, and it's there. But daily community newspapers are really important. I've worked at a bunch of them, and I gotta tell you, with very few exceptions, the people that do this kind of job every day are dedicated to the idea that there's a sacred trust there, that they're bringing people information that they need. And people like at the Times-Picayune and at the Birmingham News and at the Huntsville Times, they're not making six figures. And they're not...
Oh, no, they're not. They're probably not making five.
I'll tell you, my wife actually worked at two of those newspapers at various times in her career. And it's just, it's a real sad thing to happen. It's sad for the people in the communities. It's sad for democracy as a whole. And it's sad because a lot of these people, you know, they're journalists. Yes, they're mainstream media, but they're working folks. And
And I draw a real distinction there, John. I truly do. There's a big difference between George Will or David Brooks and the guy who covers the police blotter in Huntsville.
Yeah.
I mean, you can drive a truck through the gap between them, or a fleet of them. I mean, the community newspapers, you're absolutely right. Community newspapers are the glue that holds the town together. Or some substantial part of that glue.
Yeah, well, they're a big part of it because, you know, they do work that, you know, I mean, of course, every paper does bad work and whatever, but they keep people informed about what their government officials are doing, where their tax dollars are going, and they hold folks, you know, who spend that money accountable. And that's kind of maybe a rosy, you know, sort of picture of it, but it happens. And it would be a very, very bad thing, not just for, you know, working people, but for our democracy as a whole, if daily newspapers disappeared. And that seems to be where the industry's going. And again, trust me on this. I'm on the inside. That's the direction. And it's a real shame. And this is just a very bad sign for us as a society, I think.
Right, because it creates more space, I think, John, for the ideological partisans to control the public discourse.
Yeah.
And the same thing happened in radio. You know, you probably well remember when Clear Channel bought up practically every radio station in the United States, it seemed, after Bill Clinton signed the 1996 Telecommunications Act into law. There was a train car derailment or some such in one of the Dakotas, I think. I'm probably getting this about 99% wrong. But the gist of it was there was a need to inform the public that they needed to take certain precautions. Well, they naturally, the first responders called the radio station.
Yeah.
Well, there was no radio station at the radio station, John. The radio station was simply...
automated thing?
Yeah, it was just all automation, and it was just running a satellite feed onto the local airwaves from wherever the central processor was for Clear Channel. And that put at that point in time, it put that entire community in grave danger. And that still obtains in a lot of cities today. And if that goes away and the local paper goes away, what's left?
Well, not a whole lot, I would argue. And I'm increasingly convinced that media is one of those things, and I know Molloy talks about some things that he says are just too important to be left up to profit, you know, transportation and defense and some other things. I'm probably getting this wrong, but I mean, I've heard him say this before.
Yeah, and water, really clean air.
Utilities, right, exactly. I mean, that things that, you know, public transportation, things that can't make a profit and aren't really designed to, but we've decided need to be profitized. And I'm just convinced more and more that media is one of them. I mean, for God's sake, it's in the Constitution. Why can we let, you know, the press fail as a people? Aren't we failing ourselves in the document that binds us as a people and created us as a people?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And you know, everyone says that the Internet threw this all into chaos. I say no. because there were problems in print media long before the internet came along. Because there was the constant, you know, the constant dynamic challenge between between advertising revenue versus speaking truth to power. And again, the same thing obtains in broadcast, where the salespeople say, you can't report that. I mean, they're an advertiser. What are you thinking? And yeah, and it's at some point that runs head on, headlong into each other. And the way it's supposed to work is that the need to inform the public is supposed to trump the need to make a buck.
Right.
But we've run in allowing the bean counters. Sorry, no offense intended. But allowing the money department to rule the journalism department, I think that more than the internet is where the problems came from.
Yeah, I mean, they're a very large media company in this country, I can tell you, is on record as saying that in 10 years there will no longer be a print paper. That's their goal, and they're willing to sacrifice revenues for it in the short term. Because the end result is to be online only, if at all, and to get rid of all the journalists who are making, you know, a living that you can support a family on, basically. And get rid of them and hire them back at, you know, half of the pay for kids right out of college who sort of don't really know anything else, you know.
Right.
And that's the goal. And it's troubling and it's,
and you know, you see little signposts of the problems that are out there. For instance, that newspaper in central Louisiana that last week or week before ran the full page ad stating that Obama wanted to murder Catholics and other Christians.
Yep.
And their editorial department said, you know, we vet everything that runs here, and we felt like that was fair.
I know that company well, I will say.
Do you really?
I do.
And
we should leave it at that.
Okay, but I mean, how does that pass a vetting process? I mean, is there any factual evidence whatsoever, John, to suggest that Barack Obama wants to just go out and start blowing away priests?
Well, if there was a vetting process, the vetting process goes to, you know, what is this going to make us? You know, I mean, that's really my opinion on that. I'm doubtful that there was a vetting process, but yeah.
The vetting, well, no, I think there was a vetting process, John. You know what the vetting process consisted of?
Hmm.
Hey, Mel, the check clear from them people that said Obama's going to kill the Catholic priests? Sure did. Run it.
Bingo. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, and that's the real problem, and that's why I'm saying that I think that we need to come to the realization that the profit motive doesn't really have a place in this. And you know where else it doesn't have a place? And I'll segue, you know, quickly, because I want to let some other folks in. It doesn't have a place in history and heritage.
Hear, hear.
Right, and where I'm going with that, again, I talked to you about this. And folks, and I'd really be curious to hear from the Canadian listeners. The issue is going on in Parks Canada, which is like the National Park Service in the U.S. Here they run the country's historic sites, and they employ archaeologists and historians and public interpreters, and they staff the, you know, the natural and historical resource sites. Well, they have decided, as far as I know, it's for sure, that they're going to slash the budgets for the personnel who work for those sites, like 50% or more. To put it this way, the last archaeological field school that I directed would have had more people, more archaeologists working on it than will be working in all of Canada outside of Ontario.
Dear God.
And this, yeah, that gives it some perspective, I think. And I had maybe 12 students. There's going to be
and you know, when we first started discussing this, John, it kind of blew my mind, because is there any evidence out there? Well, we're talking about the Harper government, right?
Yeah.
Do they have any data to suggest that Canada has stopped going to its national parks?
As far as I know, they don't. And from what little I know of Canadians, I highly, highly doubt that. They seem like a very intelligent, very folks who are appreciative of their heritage and their place in the world, I would think.
And there's a lot of heritage and places in Canada, you know, from literally from east to west. I mean, the places that were Vinland, all the way to the, you know, to the native cultures of the of the of the West Coast. And so all the national funding for those places within the public trust just going to disappear?
Is going to disappear. The plan right now is to have one Parks Canada archaeologist whose duty covers the entire Canadian Arctic, which is a rather large place.
Yeah.
And a rather important place for a very large amount of heritage and native history and prehistory, et cetera, et cetera. And it, this is the thing. This is the...
And let's remember that there is not... It's not just a tourism... there's a tourism and a teaching component, but there is also a preservation component, John.
Yes.
You know, there are plenty of pot hunters left in the world. There are plenty of people who will dig stuff out of the earth and, you know, brush the dirt off of it, maybe, and take it and sell it to some collector, to sell it to somebody for more money. It's a huge business, is it not?
It is an enormous business, and wow, the profit really does roll downhill, doesn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, and of course that's a business model that the right wing, whether it be American or Canadian, embraces.
Well, of course it does. It's the same kind of thinking that says we don't need, you know, government workers, meaning teachers and firemen and cops and et cetera, et cetera. You know, we don't need this. We don't need to preserve our heritage. We don't need to open it up for, you know, for protection or for tourism and economic development. And that's the thing is that, you know, NPS sites and Parks Canada sites generate a decent amount of money. I mean, people go and visit them, and they spend their money, and it's a money making sort of thing. And they don't, they're short sighted, or it's not enough, or they want to clear the way for development. I really honestly
see. I think it's that third one, John.
Maybe so.
The beautiful places on Earth can only be appreciated by the beautiful people. And the beautiful people are defined by the amount of beautiful money they possess.
There you go. Yeah, the 1% is the beautiful side, and it's just troubling. And I see a connection between those two things, and maybe it's not there, but just two really really troubling stories, and I kind of wanted just to get them out there because I feel like they haven't gotten a whole lot of play. So
I'm very glad you did, and we will look for input from the Canadian side of the audience. But if there's any, just based on what I've seen coming from some of our Canadian listeners, there is deep, deep, deep concern about just what it is that the Harper government has in store for Canada, because the Harper government is not that ideologically different from the United States right wing. Right wing is right wing is right wing.
He's always seemed like Bush North to me. I'm seeing this from a distance, so I don't know. But
No, I don't think your assessment is far off the mark, John.
Yeah. Well, listen, thanks a lot. I really appreciate you letting me vent a little bit, and I'm looking forward to hearing your other callers. So I'll get out of your way here.
John, you have yourself a good evening, and enjoy your Save the Endangered Hillbilly T-shirt. And thanks for the outreach that you've made. To Representative Hinchey and his likely eventual successor, and I'll try to get a copy of the bill into his hands. The bill is in Representative Hinchey's email, so the Dear Colleague letter went out a week ago, and it went out via email, so every member has the bill in their possession.
Oh, great. Good to hear. Well, like I said, the people I talked to were receptive, so that's a good sign. Maybe the word hasn't trickled down to the phone callers yet. So.
Cool. Excellent. Well, thank you again very, very much.
My pleasure, Bob. Take care of yourself and your family.
All right. Will do. You too. Take care, John. Bye. From New York, that's our buddy, Dr. John. And onward we go. Hey, welcome to the program. Anybody? Someday I'll be able to afford a producer. Let's see. Contribution update. We are $25 away. We are $25 away from matching Darlene's challenge. She has $100 to kick into the kitty and would like to see that matched by another kindred hundred. So there we go. We are $25 away, and thank you for all of you
who have kindly contributed. This coming from Ron and Raleigh, based on Edward's remarks about the and my remarks about the Atlantic coast of the southern Atlantic coast. That same tax scam was used on Hilton Head and Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, as well as all along the coastal barrier islands in North Carolina. It's what the 1% does when the 1% wants what the 99% have. Is this the part of the program where I remind us they want it all? Not most of it. Not a big chunk of it. They want it all. And if we could be returned somehow, if the right wing could return us somehow to a sort of tenant serfdom, don't kid yourself. They would gladly do it and make some sort of economic sharecroppers of all of us that they haven't already managed to do. Andy, writing in from California, he says, regarding your conversation with Dr. John, newspapers have always held a special place in our democracy. Giving them special distribution rights, discounts, through that big government postal service. Thank Bubba, ex-President Bill Clinton, for helping to further destroy mass media in this country, going from about 90 outlets across the country, controlling about 90% of the media landscape, to six major conglomerates not long after the 1996 Telecommunications Act passed. Don't forget, Clear Channel, one of the biggest radio outfits, is owned by, oh, thank you for the reminder, Andy, Bain Capital, which laid off roughly 3,000 employees to create that single voice recording, one message, across the country to propel the propaganda, or, as Dim Leader used to say, to catapult the propaganda. Thank you very, very kindly. We have met Darlene's challenge. That gets us off to a good start, a very good start for this week. It is about 23 minutes before the hour, and I didn't do it because it was Morian Monday. I didn't do it, but I wanted to take a minute because I said I would every night and urge you, if you have not yet, to please call your member of Congress. Their office has in their possession a Dear Colleague letter signed by Representatives Dennis Kucinich and Louise Slaughter, asking them to sign on to the Appalachian Community Health Emergency Act, the AIC Act. It will take very little of your time for you to do this. Call your congressperson's office. Ask them to sign on this week as an original co-sponsor of the AIC Act. It is the most important piece of legislation affecting Appalachia now. There's no other piece of legislation that will go through the Congress that will have a greater impact on Central Appalachia than the Appalachian Community Health Emergency Act. We must know what it is and why it is that a woman who is carrying a child and lives in a mountaintop removal community, we must know what it is and why it is that she has 181% greater chance of giving birth to a baby with respiratory birth defects than a mother who doesn't live in a mountaintop removal community and smokes like a chimney. We must know that answer, and this is the means by which we find it out. We had a great brainstorming session with David from Maine this past Friday about all of this. You can make a difference. The right wing talks about how it loves the little unborn babies. With a single phone call and some advocacy to your member of Congress, you can exhibit more concern for the unborn in Appalachia than all the right-wingers, all the Tony Perkinses, all the James Dobsons, all the Jerry Falwells, all the Pat Robertsons, all the Creflo Dollars thrown together with one phone call. one phone call. Now, I will ask you, when you make that contact, do as others have done. Please shoot me a note and tell me who you contacted so I, in turn, can turn around and tell the rest of the AIC team who contact has been made with, because it's very effective to make a coordinated effort where we get to walk in and say, we know you're hearing from your constituents who want you to sign on to this bill. Please do so. That makes it doubly effective. Can you do it? You can learn about the AIC Act at stoptheaic.org, and you can learn about it at crmw.net. Also at crmw.net, which is the home of Coal River Mountain Watch, you can get your very own, as Dr. John mentioned, you can get your very own Save the Endangered Hillbilly t-shirt, the coolest t-shirt going. They're not very expensive at all, and it goes to help support the work of Coal River Mountain Watch, which does, in fact, include the AIC campaign. And anywhere you go, it will be a conversation starter. God knows it's a conversation starter around here. Sadly, because of the nature of things around here, the conversation usually begins with, "You son of a bitch! Tree hugger!" But others say, "I agree. I agree." And since you've listened to this program, you are probably more and better informed about mountaintop removal than just about anybody else in this country. And you, therefore, are in a prime position to do some missionary work and some educating when you wear your Save the Endangered Hillbilly t-shirt and people ask you what it's all about. I know our buddy Jug of Punch has one, too. And it is a conversation starter. Mentioning mountaintop removal reminds me there was some breaking news today, just before showtime. I got it from our friends over at the Rainforest Action Network. They were the ones who made it possible for me to go and speak to Bank of America down in Charlotte in early May in that room full of locked and loaded firearms borne by off-duty police officers. It was a little nervous time. But it turns out that Bank of America got the message. You might recall that part of what I said to them was that they had made me sad because Brian Moynihan, I think that was his name, CEO, said he didn't envision Bank of America's policy on coal changing. Well, apparently he wasn't lying. It turns out that today, Bank of America, in an act of really cynical greenwashing, made a big announcement. Today's announcement builds on Bank of America's legacy of leadership in the environmental arena. Well, it kind of depends on how you define leadership, I reckon. What they said is that they will fund, to the tune of billions of dollars, renewable energy. That part is good. But to the extent that they, but what they didn't do is what matters. They didn't change their policy on coal. As Rand notes, plain and simple, increasing support for renewable energy and not decreasing funding for coal will not do what's needed to reduce emissions or protect the climate. Rand goes on to note, Bank of America's commitment to renewable energy is a step in the right direction for the climate. However, The bank is simultaneously taking two steps back by continuing to underwrite the coal industry. The bottom line is we cannot reduce the emissions necessary to stem climate change with renewable energy funding alone. We must also curb our use of coal, and Bank of America's new environmental commitment makes no move to do that. Bank of America boasts about increasing its commitments to renewable energy, but omits reporting its steadily increasing financing for coal, the number one source of U.S. climate pollution. Between 2010 and 2011, Bank of America provided more than $6.4 billion in underwriting for U.S. coal, and that includes the companies that are blowing up Appalachia and shipping it overseas. They produced a video. I thought I'd go ahead and share the audio with you. These are some of the folks who traveled to Charlotte for the shareholder meeting. It's a pretty strong message, and I really appreciate them doing this. RAND is a very good organization.
I'm Beth Henry.
My name is Noel Chandler.
I'm Adam Hall.
My name is Matt.
I'm Bob Kincaid.
Hi, I'm Kristen Owen, and I'm from the heart of King Coal, Laramie, Wyoming.
I'm from Glendaniel, West Virginia.
I'm from Charlotte, North Carolina.
I'm from Missoula, Montana.
I'm here from Bellingham, Washington.
I'm from Fayette County, West Virginia. I'm a ninth generation Appalachian.
I've lost about 80% of my family due to coal-connected diseases.
Massive amounts of birth defects.
What we have now is nothing compared to what is actually being proposed.
We have a virtual asthma epidemic here.
The two largest coal export facilities in North America. One of those is right in my waterway.
Cancers, heart disease, pulmonary disease, genitourinary disease.
Lead, mercury, uranium, cadmium.
Increasing lung cancer here, even though smoking is dangerous.
Breathing this in, I know it can't be good for me.
I'm here to tell Bank of America.
I'm here to tell Bank of America.
Tell Bank of America.
Tell Bank of America.
And I'm here to tell Bank of America
that what they're doing with coal finance is not okay.
That the financing of coal must stop.
Stop funding mountaintop removal coal.
And poisoning communities all throughout America.
Time for us to put an end to profits over people.
We want Bank of America to stop funding dirty coal and instead fund the future, clean, renewable energy.
Pretty clear message, huh? Yeah, I was in there. But that's not why I played it. I would have played it if I wasn't. What's inspiring is to hear Bellingham, Washington, Wyoming, Montana, North Carolina, West Virginia. It's inspiring to hear that because it lets you know that this truly has become a nationwide effort. And when you meet people like I met in Germany, from Indonesia, from India, my friends Itan and Ashish, my new friends, then you know that it has gone global. And there is an unwillingness to remain silent any longer. For the love of God, these profiteering monsters are poisoning us. They're killing us. It is impossible to be of good conscience and remain silent under those circumstances. My new friends in Germany, Peter and his son Max, live in a town whose viewshed, for want of a better term, will soon be a matter of looking out from a village that is 1,000 years old, that sits on ground that the legions marched over 2,000 years ago. The view from their home will be
of a vast, open, 1,400-foot-deep cancer of a strip mine in West Central Germany. One of the countries that is doing more toward to moving toward renewables and sustainables than any country on the planet. And yet their 1% and a corporation called RWE remains hell-bent on burning the last of the filthiest energy source that their country has remaining. 1,400 feet into the earth to scrape out a layer of something that isn't even coal, lignite. It's just the one step above peat moss and carboniferous mud. It's 33% water, lignite. And that will be the view of my German friends when they go for a walk in that beautiful, beautiful little village. Their village will at least still be there. Five others will be gone. It's already begun. The operations of Coal India in the subcontinent are the stuff that defines predatory corporate practices. The beautiful, tropical, lush Indonesian jungle where Etan's people come from is now a cancerous scar visible from space. And for what? For security? No. For the constant drive for more profit, more junk, more consumable crap that adds not one iota to the value of